So chapter 11 of Daniel. And in chapter 11 is kind of a continuation. I'm talking loud. I'm going to talk as loud as I can. So you all turn up your ears here. Yeah, I'll probably do a little microphone and a little speaker system, especially with the noise coming down. But Daniel chapter 10. Do what? Yeah, that's true. Me too. Chapter 10 of Daniel begins to change the complexion of the way the book of Daniel is. Chapter 10 is kind of a prelude to the last vision in the book of Daniel. Chapters 11 and 12 are the amplification of that vision. And some of it is going to happen, has happened already. And that's what we're going to look at today. Chapter 11 is really too big to get done in one session. So we're going to have to break it apart. And we're going to do half of it today. We're going to finish it next week. And then we'll do chapter 12 the following week of the book of Daniel. So hopefully we'll get enough done today that I can complete the first half of the vision. And the first half of the vision is about things that came to pass within a couple of hundred years after the prophet Daniel died, but are not left still to come. And you know, when we looked at chapters 8 and 9 and we saw the prophecy of the 70 weeks of Daniel, we understood that 69 weeks of those were already complete, and the 70th week of Daniel is that week that's reserved for what we call the Great Tribulation, the seven-year period between the peace treaty with the Israel with the Antichrist and the time of the second coming. So that's the seven-year period. And that's the 70th week of Daniel. So much of what we're going to study next week and the following week regards that 7 weeks. And what we're going to look at today gets us up to that point. It's kind of important. Now, we also know this, when you look at it, Daniel will say this is a vision. And again, the difference between a vision and a dream is a dream happens when you're asleep. A vision happens when you're awake. So Daniel is awake during this conversation with an angel. He probably wishes he was asleep, but he was awake during this conversation. So he's clear to point out this is a vision, not a dream. And we'll see a little bit of that as we begin to look at it. This is the final vision that we have from him in this. And as I mentioned before, when we started the book of Daniel, one of the problems the book of Daniel has in terms of historical review by people who study the Bible is the accuracy of the book of Daniel is unbelievably accurate. And of course, people who are not believers in prophecy say it couldn't be that accurate unless it was written after everything and he's just writing history. But the believers of Bible prophecy would say that's what Bible prophecy is somebody speaking history in the future. We're going to see what God wants to happen, but we're going to see it in a future text. So it's kind of an interesting discussion that the major claim against the book of Daniel is the accuracy of its prophecy. But as we mentioned before, there's been copies of it found or pieces of it found in the Qumran scrolls, which predate the time when they claim that Daniel was written in a later date. So they've got a little bit of a problem here with actual archaeology supporting the writing of Daniel at the time of the capture in Babylon. So we're gonna just talk a little bit about what happens, but I'm going to try to relate, and I'm not going to get all the Roman names correct, and I'm not going to get all the emperors correct. If you want to read them, this book is incredible book in terms of listing all of the people and all the prophecies, and you can wear yourself out reading it from a historical perspective. But if you actually want to research all of the accuracy within here, this book is a good one because it calls out the names of all the things and how they happen. I'll go through as many of those as I can remember as we go through it. But if you have a question, stop me, and if I have to, I'll look it up in here because it's pretty important. Now, last week in chapter 10, just as a recap, Daniel is out on the Tigris River. He's north of Babylon, and he was in charge of a lot of things. So he was out surveying what he was in charge of, had a bunch of people with him, chapter 10, and all of a sudden, this bright light, this incredible sound begins to happen. Everybody who's with him runs away and hides. They see the sound, they hear the sound, they see the light, They see the great disturbance and they're scared to death. Daniel's scared to death, but Daniel, since the vision is meant for him, he sees the angel. And he doesn't run, he just passes out and falls to the ground, you know, kind of half conscious. He's just in a stupor. And the angel comes and speaks to him, lifts him up, sets him on his knees, and tells him not to be afraid. Kind of a little late for that. He should have said that when he first arrived. But he tells Daniel not to be afraid. And then he stands Daniel up on his feet to hear the prophecy. And that's about where we end chapter 10. And so you're about to hear the prophecy. I want to open the Bible to the last couple of verses in chapter 10 and the first verse in chapter 11. And we're going to read those because that's going to set the stage for chapter 11. So let me look at those right now. And I'm going to read from verse 20, 21, and 11:1. So verse 20 of chapter 10 says, "So he said, 'Do you know why I have come to you?'" This is the angel speaking now to Daniel. "Soon I will return to fight against the prince of Persia, and when I go, the prince of Greece will come." Now, remember the conversation. The prince of Persia and the prince of Greece are the demonic angels that are part of Satan's crowd that are trying to steer everything away from God. And so God has his angels trying to steer it back. And this angel is the one who's in charge of Persia. And so he's fighting against the angel of Persia. He'll fight against the fallen angel of Greece also. And he talks about earlier that Michael came to help him. And Michael is the angel of the Israeli people, or the people of God. So he talks about that. It's kind of interesting to see the hierarchy of angels. But he says, "But first," in verse 21, "I will tell you what is written in the book of truth." Book of truth is that book that contains the history of the world, all of the deeds of everyone in it. Must be a big book. But it's the book of truth that God has. And it's mentioned many times in the Old and New Testament. And it's the book of what's going to happen. Don't confuse that with the book of deeds when we're judged, or the book of our works when we're judged in the white throne judgment. Hopefully none of us there, but hopefully we're judged at the judgment seat of Christ. And so he's going to tell Daniel what's written in this book, this history book of the world that's to come. And then he says, "No one supports me against them except Michael, your prince." And that's just an allusion to the fact that, you know, we mentioned like Texas Rangers, one ranger. The Lord only needs one angel to control Persia. But when he needs help, Michael comes over to help the Jews to help him out. So no one supports him in that. And he's not playing pity me. He's just basically saying that he's got to go back because that's his job. That's his angelic job, to go back and be that force restraining evil over there. And then in verse 1 of 11, which is kind of the wrap-up of this whole thought, it says, "In the first year of Darius the Mede, I took my stand to support and protect him." So even the angel is supporting a non-believer here in Darius, because Darius is fighting against Satan's angels, and Darius is useful to this angel to accomplish God's purpose. So we see that God supports men and women who are in charge of things, even when they're not godly people, because they serve his purpose. We saw that with Nebuchadnezzar. We see that in other parts of the book of Daniel. So we begin now. So Daniel has been stood up. He's ready to listen to the prophecy. He's been given strength by the angel. The angel stood him up, and now he's getting ready to tell him. And let's take a look at verses 2 through 4. Let me just say, first of all, when you hear the term, your Bible may have a little different translation depending on what your Bible is. But in this chapter, when you hear the king of the south, that is the king of Egypt. When you hear the king of the north, that is the king of the Syrian Empire. That is the empire that was broken up after the time of Alexander the Great. So the king of the north and the king of the south is in relation to Israel. So, you know, Israel is here, Egypt is here, and Syria is up here. So that's the reference here. So don't equate these directly with Revelation, the king of the north, the king of the south, which are different kings because the context of Revelation is different. So, okay. So verse is 2 through 4. It says, "Now then, I tell you the truth. Three more kings will appear in Persia, and then a fourth. he will be far richer than all the others. When he has gained power by his wealth, he will stir up everyone against the kingdom of Greece. Then a mighty king will appear who will rule with great power and do as he pleases. After he has appeared, his empire will be broken up and parceled out towards the four winds of heaven. It will not go to his descendants, nor will it have the power he exercised, because his empire will be uprooted and given to others. Now, we know this because of Daniel 8 and 9. This is really talking about the end of the Medo-Persian Empire that ruled over Babylon, and the ascendancy of the Greek Empire, which was dominated by Alexander the Great. And so we see here in this prophecy another, again, this is hundreds of years before this happens, but we see this prophecy called out that three more kings will come in Persia. Now, if you remember from 8 and 9, they happen pretty quickly because, you know, the kings are always killing each other to gain power. Their sons, their daughters, their brother-in-laws, their, you know, their generals, whatever. It's pretty dangerous to be a king, you know, in this old time. So three more kings will come. The fourth will come. The fourth will determine to take on Greece. And yet Alexander the Great will kill him. And Alexander the Great then becomes the most powerful king in all of the area. But as we remember also, he died at the age of 32 years old. And he had no heirs at the time, or his heirs were infants. I don't remember which, maybe infants. And his kingdom was divided among his four generals. He was a good king in the sense that he had set up four regions to govern all of the land he had conquered. And so the region that governed Babylon was set up in what we call Syria today. And so it was the Syrian group of Alexander the Great. And that's the one that becomes the king of the north in later times. So he says, so he's prophesying this. This actually comes true. And you can read all the names of the kings. And if you study this, the historical references are very accurate because of all the record keeping that took place, you know, by all of these kings and the people that wrote down all of the history. And then it says, after he has appeared, his empire will be broken up and parceled out towards the four winds of heaven. In other words, just given away to the four generals that owned the four corners of his empire. It will not go to his descendants, nor will it have the power he exercised. They were four independent kingdoms. They never had the same power as the united Macedonian Greek empire of Alexander the Great. And it says his empire will be uprooted and given to others. And that's really because each of the generals was a powerful general from the other armies that had come to work for Alexander the Great. When they took over, it sort of reverted back to their old tribal ways. And then verse 5 says, the king of the south will become strong. This is Egypt now. The king in Egypt will become strong. But one of his commanders will become even stronger than he and will rule his own kingdom with great power. Now, one of the things you'll see here, none of these countries were identified yet as we see them today. But the land that we call Gaza today, the land that we call Lebanon, the land that we call Syria, Golan Heights, all of those are very prominent in the prophecies that take place because of the battles that took place and where the kingdoms were. And the Philistines, if you remember them from the earlier biblical times, the Philistines were the indigenous people that lived in this whole area of Gaza along through Syria. And that's sort of the descendant of the name Palestinian that comes from Philistine. And so it's kind of interesting to see how this all works and how it plays out when you come to today's world and look at the various infighting that goes on among all of these so-called Arabs, you know, that are not really the same. They're the same religion and probably some heritage, but they're all very tribal and they don't like one another and they support one another only until they get to a point where they get strong enough, then they kill the others off. And we see that's been, you know, endemic in that whole region of the world. So the king of the south will become strong. One of his commanders will become even stronger. He will rule his own kingdom with great power. After some years, they will become allies. And the daughter of the king of the south will go to the king of the north to make an alliance. But she will not retain her power, and his power will not last. In those days, she'll be handed over together with her royal escort and her father and the ones who supported her. Now, let me just say here that the Syrian Empire is not a kingdom early. It's a rulership or kind of a viceroyship out of this old empire of Alexander. But after a while, the rulers there, the Antiochus rulers, become kings, and they set themselves up as kings. And because there's animosity between the Syrian and the Egyptian, they decide that one of the ways they're going to fix that is they're going to marry one of the daughters into the other kingdom. And you know, that was rampant in all through Europe. You know, kings and queens would marry a son or a daughter off to a royal family member of another empire to solidify friendships and treaties and other kinds of things. I guess being a royal daughter was kind of an interesting deal at that time, because you know, you were just packed off and sent somewhere to marry the king of someplace else. And we know historically, if you just look at the kings and queen of England, they're Germanic. Their history is German, and they came over from somebody coming from the German side to marry into the English side. And the English were not really English; they were, you know, they were French and they were Scottish and they were, you know. So it's kind of a big pool of royal blood that sort of gets sprinkled around to cement alliances, and no different here. And this lady's name is Bernice, Berenice, and she's married off to an Antiochus in Syria. But he only lives a couple of years, and he dies. Now, just to kind of give you a history of the world at that time, Bernice, this guy was married to a lady named Laodice. She was probably from Laodicea, up in the Asia Minor area, little town where we see Laodicea in Revelation as one of the churches. So she's probably from that area. Maybe her husband is too, but she's married to him, and she is sort of the queen. Well, to cement this alliance, the king of Egypt forces the king of the north to dispose of his wife and put her aside and marry Bernice. Well, you can just see a little bit of a problem. So the king of Egypt dies. So now the enforcer that kept the king of the north married to Bernice dies. So the king of the north decides he's going to push Bernice aside, and he's going to go back and marry his old wife. And so he goes back and marries his old wife. And she decides that she's going to have Bernice killed and the infant son that was born to her husband. So she does that, and that's where you see this prophecy that says, after some years there will come allies. The daughter of the king of the south will go to the king of the north to make an alliance, but she will not retain her power, and he and his power will not last. In those days she'll be handed over together with her royal escort, and her father, means and the descendants of her father, and the ones who supported her. Now she's actually killed, and there's historical reference about the way she's killed. So that doesn't go over real well with the people back in Egypt. And we'll see how that plays in as we get a little further down. So Bernice is killed, and now Laodice comes back to be king, the wife of the king of the north. And what's funny is, when one of them dies, they just become queen of the, you know, they marry their brother, they marry their sister, or their, you know, whatever it happens to be, to continue the line. It's just, you know, the royal line is so important that, you know, kinship doesn't matter. Brothers and sisters, aunts and uncles, you know, it's all pretty incestuous at that point. But so anyway, Laodice becomes the queen, and she, you know, she begins to take her place. And then in verse 7, it says, one of her family line will arise to take her place. So Bernice is gone. She was hopefully she was going to retain power at the king of the north. But her brother, back in Egypt, another Ptolemy. Ptolemy is the line of the pharaohs. So Ptolemy becomes another power. It's, I don't know, Ptolemy 3 or 4 or whatever. They come in sequence, and they always change their last name, like Ptolemy, Sopater, Ptolemy. The last name is what they give to honor who they are, like King of the World, or the Exuberance of God, or they always name some name to give them special, you know, the Magnificent, whatever they call themselves. So this other Ptolemy comes to power. It will arise to take her place. He will attack the forces of the king of the north, enter his fortress. He'll fight against them and be victorious. Now, it's interesting. He defeats the king of the north. He will also seize their gods, their metal images, their valuable artifacts of silver and gold, and carry them all back to Egypt. So, but he doesn't get the king. The king escapes. The king of the north escapes. But the king of the south is pretty content with the fact that he's defeated him pretty soundly, killed off his army. So he goes back to Egypt and is pretty satisfied with what he's done. The next verse says, for some years he will leave the king of the north alone. And the king of the north will invade the realm of the king of the south, but will retreat to his own country. So he comes down to invade, but he doesn't get very far, so he retreats back. You can see the animosity building between these kings. And that's one of the reasons why, you know, the Egyptians have really no love loss for the Palestinians. They never have. They would almost, and historically they've taken the side of the Jews in many cases as opposed to the Palestinians, because they've been treacherous. Of course, the Egyptians have too, so it's been kind of a dual treachery that's been going on for thousands of years. And so this king goes back, and it says, his sons will prepare for war and assemble a great army, which will sweep in like an irresistible flood and carry the battle as far as its fortress. Now, if you read history, there are 70,000 warriors on each side of this battle. 70,000. So you can just imagine the tromp, tromp, tromp of the horses and whatever battle armaments, however they moved their armies at this time, coming down to do battle, 70,000 of them. And they would be like an irresistible flood to an undefended small city. And they'll carry the battle as far as its fortress. So they get all the way to the fortress of Egypt. And it says, then the king of the south will march out in a rage and fight against the king of the north, who will raise a large army, but it will be defeated. When the army is carried off, the king of the south will be filled with pride and slaughter many thousands. So the king of the south waits until they get right upon him, and then he marches his 70,000 troops out, catches them, and kills 70,000 of them. And he's pretty smug in his win. Filled with pride and will slaughter many thousands. Yet he will not remain triumphant. For the king of the north, who escapes, these kings are, you know, they sit up on the mountaintop and they send their troops in. But if it's going bad, they get on a horse and they get out of town, because they don't want to be caught. You know, they want to come back and fight another day. And so he slips away. It says, for the king of the north will muster another army larger than the first. Wouldn't you hate to be a peasant in these towns? I mean, you know, 70,000 are killed off, and in a few years he goes back and rouses out another 70,000 or more and brings them back again. And he says, and after several years he will advance with a huge army, fully equipped. I'm sure the merchants selling arms of war are having a brisk business here. You know, whatever, swords, shields, you know, armaments, whatever they sold. Verse 14. In those times, many will rise against the king of the south. Egypt was in its days of glory. Egypt was powerful. They had their own armies. They had their own chariots. They did battle, you know, Egyptian style. And then it says here, and this is an interesting verse, because none of these verses are throwaway verses. They all have a hook into something later. And it says here, after 14, in those times, many will rise against the king of the south. Then it says, the violent men among your own people will rebel in fulfillment of the vision, but without success. So he's telling Daniel that the violent men among the Jews, you know, and the Jews have always had extreme, you want to call them Zionists, extreme Zionists, you know, who wanted to go kill the Romans when they were there, who wanted to fight to the death when the Romans were there in Jesus' time. You know, the Maccabees who fought to the death. There's always been a strain of the Jewish that is also very much into the jihad, if you want to use that term, in terms of killing their opponents. And it's no different then. And so they decided that they liked the Egyptians better than the Syrians. So they took the side of the Egyptians and helped them, probably spied in the land. And when they were coming, they sent spies to tell them when they were coming and all this kind of stuff. Which, of course, you know, they didn't do what the Swiss do, which is, don't take sides. Sit back in their house and not take sides. So they took sides, which didn't endear them to the Syrians. And it's in fulfillment of the vision. And you know, the vision that we had before, we talked about Antiochus Epiphanes, who was the king several hundred years later, who who desecrated the temple. That's in direct response to the fact that the Jews were allied with the Egyptians. So these little throwaway verses that you read really are the things that provide some of the links into what happens later on. So this is the reason why the Syrians were so vengeful in going after the Jews. And it says in verse 15, then the king of the north will come and build up siege ramps and will capture a fortified city. Now, anybody know what siege ramps are? I know Randy probably knows what siege ramps are. Siege ramps are, you know, when they had a big fortress town and they couldn't scale the walls, you know, they had ladders and things they built, which were called siege ramps, that they could lean against the walls, and then their armies could march up and down very quickly and, you know, overwhelm them. And so they had planned for this attack and built these siege ramps. And, you know, there were all different kinds of siege ramps. Some were wide enough for horses to get up. Some were just narrow like ladders. But they laid these things up, and they'd come up in such quantities that they couldn't fight them off. And they would get inside the city, and they'd open the gates. And then, all the big armaments would go in. And so siege ramps were a technique of early armor, you know, armories. And the whole idea was, we overwhelm them with force, and they can't resist us. And once we've penetrated their fortress, then we can attack them from the inside, open the gates, and let our armies in. So the fact that siege ramps gives you a clue that even in this vision, hundreds of years before, the angel is telling Daniel how this is going to happen. And will capture a fortified city. The forces of the south will be powerless to resist. Even their best troops will not have the strength to stand. So once the siege ramps are in place and they overpower the city, I don't care how good the soldiers are, how good their swords are, how good their armaments are, they can't resist. And, you know, this is the same scenario when you read in Book of Revelation, you talk about the army of 200 million people coming from the east, which we all think is probably the Chinese, who, you know, I don't care how many of them you kill, there's a million more of them right behind them. And so, you know, you can't kill enough of them to stop them. And that's really the situation you have here. Verse 16 says, the invader will do as he pleases. No one will be able to stand against him. He will establish himself in the beautiful land. The beautiful land here is Israel. It's the land of the promised land. And they call it the beautiful land here. And will have the power to destroy it. Verse 17, he will determine to come with the might of his entire kingdom and will make an alliance with the king of the south. And he will give him a daughter in marriage in order to overthrow the kingdom. But his plans will not succeed or help him. Now, interestingly enough, this daughter, is anybody know the name of this daughter? She has a famous ancestor that comes later, but this daughter's name is Cleopatra. And this Cleopatra is a word that is a Greek word that has some origin in Latin, but it's really more of a Greek word. And it means, Patra means father, and Cleopatra means glory of the father. So this daughter is the glory of her father, Cleopatra. And the derivative names in today's world are Cleo and other kinds of names that people have that they've given to girls. But Cleopatra is not a real popular name for girls today because we think about the Cleopatra that we see in the movies. And she's Cleopatra the fifth, actually. This is Cleopatra the first. But anyway, she goes down into there, and so she comes from the area up where the king does, which is up in this Asia Minor area, up more like the people that we see in the Gentile churches later, of Antioch and some of those towns. So she's a Gentile, you know, she comes from that part of the world, I'm sure she's probably not Arab in feature, but she's probably different. She looks a little more Asian, has a little more of a Asian appearance to her, I would guess, dark hair. And so she comes down, glory of her father, and she's given to another Ptolemy down there in Egypt to cement the empire. And it works pretty well, except for the fact that the young king of Egypt is only 7 years old. And so Cleopatra is given to him when he's 7 years old. I don't know how old she is, but she's pretty young. And her father anticipated her to side with him in the wars to come, but she didn't. She sided with her husband, and which is kind of interesting. It created a lot of tension you know, in the I'm sure the father-daughter relationship, Father's Day and Thanksgiving were probably a little weak at that time. But anyway, she sides with her husband. And so it says, but his plans will not succeed or help him, which is interesting. I mean, this is prophesied, and it actually comes to pass, you know, in a strange way. You wouldn't think that, you know, but she was probably young also, and so she probably grew up there. She probably became friends with him when he was 7 years old, and, you know, they became family, you know, after that. And it says, then he will turn his attention to the coastlands. This is the king of the north, and will take many of them. So he decides he can't conquer Egypt the easy way, so he's going to clean house on everything getting up to Egypt. So he starts coming down the coast, and he starts taking out what we call Lebanon today. He starts taking out what we call the Golan Heights. He starts taking out what we call Gaza, and the area, you know, coming up to and around Israel. So he starts conquering all of those lands. But he says, but a commander will put an end to his insolence and will turn his insolence back upon him. Now, what we understand later, and you'll see another vision of this, is the Romans have decided that they have an interest in Egypt. And so they send a commander with his troops. And this king Antiochus, comes down towards Egypt, and the Roman commander stops him, draws a circle around him physically, and tells him he's got to decide whether he wants to do battle with Rome or go back home, and he's got to decide it before he leaves the circle, or the Romans are going to kill him right there. A little pressure. So he decides that he's going to retreat and go back up the coast. And the Romans don't care about Syria and don't care about the others. They just want Egypt because of all the history of Egypt and, you know, all the glory of Egypt. So he goes back. It's kind of interesting because we see the Romans begin to assert themselves very early in this scenario, but their power base is far away, and all he's got is probably a garrison of Roman troops that are down there at the time. It says, after this, he will turn back towards the fortresses of his own country and will stumble and fall to be seen no more. Now, what's the history books say that this guy, this Antiochus, whichever one he was, is decided that when on his way back, he's going to loot one of the temples of a pagan god in one of these areas. And in the process of looting one of the temples, he gets killed while looting the temple. It's not in battle. It's not in any righteous battle. He gets killed being a thief. And it says he will stumble and fall to be seen no more. Sort of like, you know, his own greed will do away with him. And that's exactly what happened. And you can understand how people who read this and look at these prophecies and study history are surprised at how accurate these historical things are that are prophesied in the 500 BC, and they don't happen for another couple of hundred years. And it says, his successor will send out a tax collector to maintain the royal splendor, of course. You know, send it back to all the lands. He sends out a tax collector. However, he will be destroyed, yet not in anger or in battle. So the tax collector is just killed because people don't like tax collectors. And he's sent back into one of these countries, and he's just, you know, he just disappears, never to be seen again.
Sounds like a good idea.
It's like when we lived in Kentucky, now this is not true today, probably. I say probably. But if you came into town in some little eastern Kentucky town, you know, Pikeville, Paintsville, and you came into town with a suit on, you were either a preacher or a revenuer. And if they determined you weren't a preacher, you were in big trouble, and you better get out of town before the night was over because of all the moonshine stills and stuff that were all over the place. And I think that's probably the case here. This guy comes to town. They determine he's a tax collector, and they just don't pay him. They just do away with him, and he disappears. And, you know, communication was not real quick. He didn't get on his BlackBerry and say, I'm in trouble, send help. He just disappeared. And it says, he will be succeeded by a contemptible person who has not been given the honor of royalty. This is Antiochus Epiphanes. We talked about him before. Epiphanes means the peak of God's glory. So he's Antiochus, the peak of God's glory. You know, he's the Epiphany, the big cheese. This is his own name for himself. And it says he's a contemptible person who will not be given the honor of royalty. Typically, a king or a queen is the son or the daughter of a king or queen, and when they die, the country honors them by elevating them to that position. This guy is an uncle to the Antiochus, and the Antiochus that dies has a young son, and he's the guardian of the young son. So he decides, you know, he flatters everybody, he gets into a position of power as the guardian, and then guess what? The young son just disappears. And he takes over because he's got now alliances, he's built alliances. So he takes over because of deceit and trickery, Antiochus Epiphany. And if you read about him, he's around for a while, and he's the guy that comes back and wreaks vengeance on Israel. He will invade the kingdom when his people feel secure, and he will seize it through intrigue. So, you know, he makes alliances with people. He's their friend. He does things for them to butter them up, and when they're looking the other way, he sneaks up on them and he kills them and he takes their kingdom. Not very well liked. Then an overwhelming army will be swept away before him. Both it and a prince of the covenant will be destroyed. A prince of the covenant is angel speak for the high priest of Jerusalem. So he's the guy that was the high priest at the time, and he's the guy that could get into the Holy of Holies. He's the guy that had access to the inner sanctum. He's the guy that represented the people to God there. And so he's called a prince of the covenant. And so this is the high priest of Israel. So the high priest of Israel is killed by Antiochus. The army of the Jews and the army of Egypt and the others that are there are all killed. And Antiochus takes over. It says, after coming to an agreement with him, he will act deceitfully. So he kills the high priest. He says, okay, guys, we're gonna honor, we're not going to do anything else to you here. We're going to keep you intact. So the Jews, wanting to be peaceable, ally with him, but he's deceitful. And after a few, and only a few people, and with only a few people, he will rise to power. And when the richest provinces feel secure, he will invade them and achieve what neither his fathers nor his forefathers did. He'll distribute plunder, loot, and wealth among his followers. So, you know how you've read about kingdoms that were overtaken, and the kings would take the prisoners, the royal family, put them in chains, lead them back through his own kingdom, and parade them in dishonor, in his honor, steal everything they had, bring it back, you know, to their glory, put it in their own warehouse. Well, this guy stole everything they had, and he gave it out to curry favor with people that he wanted to encourage to be his loyal supporters. So he gave things away to curry favor and to get them to support him. Kind of like we do with our foreign policy today. You know, we have countries that we really don't like a whole lot, but we give them billions of dollars in hopes that they will not stab us in the back. That's kind of the same idea that went on at this time. And it does. It's not really a very good strategy because it doesn't. In the long term, it never works well. You're right. And it says he will distribute plunder. And then it says he will plot the overthrow of fortresses, but only for a time. With a large army, he will stir up his strength and courage against the king of the south. The king of the south will wage war with a large and very powerful army, but he will not be able to stand because of the plots devised against him. So inside the army of the king of the south in Egypt, he's built these alliances of traitors who will betray the Egyptians, betray the Jews, betray all of the provincial rulers. When this guy comes, he's laid the groundwork for all this deceit, and they will all from inside kill their rulers, kill their leaders, kind of a plot of intrigue. And that's, you know, that's always the way it is in these empires. You never know who your enemies are. That's why when a new king comes to power, in many cases, they kill all of the other king's families, everybody, because they don't want any deceit coming up over there. They want to stamp out all pretenders to the throne. Kind of cruel, but that was a survival technique. And then it says, those who eat from the king's provisions will try to destroy him. His arm will be swept away, and many will fall in battle. So the king of the south survives, even though the armies are in tatters. The king of the north is in tatters. So they decide they're going to have a peace treaty. So they come together. In verse 27, it says, the two kings, with their hearts bent on evil, will sit at the same table and lie to each other. Doesn't this sound like negotiations today? I mean, you know, we send our president over, our secretary of state or whatever, and they sit at the table with somebody else, and they lie to one another. And we sign these treaties, and we all, you know, all these treaties, and they have no intentions of keeping them. You know, it's kind of an interesting thing, prophesied by the angel. And it says, they will lie to each other, but to no avail, because an end will still come at the appointed time. So remember, when the angel speaks, he talks about appointed times, or it has been spoken by God, or it is ordained by God. This is not a prophecy. This is a God truth that is being read out of the book of truth. So this is what's going to happen according to God. So the end time is predicted. It's going to come right on schedule, and all these lies and intrigues don't make any difference. It's still coming. The sword is coming down. When God decides, the sword is coming down. So at the appointed time, the end will still come. The king of the north will return to his own country with great wealth, but his heart will be set against the Holy Covenant. He will take actions against it and then return to his own country. At the appointed time, he will invade the south again, but this time the outcome will be different from what it was before. Ships of the western coastlands will oppose him. Yours may say something different there. I'd be interested in what yours says there, because this is a translation of the actual Greek, but the actual Hebrew, I'm sorry, but they've translated into what it really means. What's yours say, Randy?
Kittim.
Kittim, okay. Kittim was a region up on the coastland. So that's actually accurate, Kittim. This is the Romans. These are people that come down from the area of Cyprus. So the Romans understand what's happening. They probably have spies in the area. And when they see the king of the north, Assyrian, beginning to move down, they send their ships from Rome, from Cyprus, to come down. It says it will oppose him, and he will lose heart. You know, he will lose courage is what that means. Heart is the word here for courage. So he will lose courage. Then he will turn back, and he's so mad, he vents his fury against the Holy Covenant. So he's coming back, and on his way back through the beautiful land, he decides to take his frustrations out on the Jews. He will return and show favor to those who forsake the Holy Covenant. So those who join him and oppose the God of Abraham, he shows favor to. It says his armed forces will rise up to desecrate the temple fortress and abolish the daily sacrifice. So they do away with the priesthood, they do away with the daily sacrifice, they do away with the temple. But before they do that, it says then they will set up the abomination that causes desolation. This is a particular set of words that Daniel uses. We see it again in Revelation. And we begin now, up through verse 35, we're beginning to close out on the prophecy that's happened. And after verse 35, we begin to look at the prophecy that's going to come to pass. So we're going to do through verse 35 today. So the abomination that causes desolation. Now, anybody remember when we talked about this from chapters 8 and 9, what this is, what he does? He takes a big sow and he butchers it on the altar, and he kills it, and all the pig's blood runs out. They cut the meat there, they cook it on the altar, they pollute the altar, and all of his men have a big time having their giant barbecue there. And so, you know, they and for the Jews, it's desecrated their temple. You know, the only answer to them is not to clean it, but to rebuild it. They can't really. It's permanently desecrated. And that's why it's called the abomination that causes desolation. It's the thing which causes the temple and the altar to be abandoned by the Jews. And when they get back their power, they will tear it down and rebuild it, which of course they did later. It says, with flattery he will corrupt those who have violated the covenant, but the people who know their God will firmly resist him. And again, this is a call to us, even when things look lost. Even when our God looks like he's lost control, people who know their God should firmly resist those who are opposing them and hang with God. And that's good, timely advice for us in the world today as we look around and we see God's influence waning in so many places. And, you know, we look at society today and see that it's on the descent, and we wonder what's going on. And we should not lose heart here. We should firmly resist, which means we should take our stand being a people of God. We should firmly resist. You know, as for us in our household, we will follow the Lord. Verse 33, those who are wise It really means wise in the way of the Lord. So it really means godly wise. Those who are wise will instruct many, though for a time they will fall by the sword or be burned or captured or plundered. So, you know, the Jews have always had a remnant, but a lot of the Jewish religion has been decimated by all these acts, and we see it not just from them, but from then on. We've seen that, you know, as a course of action against the Jews. It says they will be sword be burned or captured or plundered. When they fall, they will receive a little help, and many who are not sincere will join them. Some of the wise will stumble so that they may be refined. Again, what this means is some of the wise in the Lord will try to appease those that are there to save what they have. But he says they will be purified and made spotless until the time of the end. And you know what happens, that's a call that says that we shouldn't be appeasers to the world and give away our godly things. Because if we are, God will refine us. And we know refining means God will put the burner under us and heat all of the impurities out of us until we're pure again. So these people who cooperated with the Syrians were put in the fire by God and purified. Not killed, put in the fire and purified and made spotless until the time of the end, for it will come at the appointed time. So again, God preserves his remnant, and we always want to be part of that remnant, you know, in today's time as well. I'm going to stop there because this really begins in verse 36. We begin to shift from what's already happened to what's going to happen. And you notice as you read some of these verses that some of this parallels what's going to happen when we see it in Revelation of the end times. So a lot of the predictions are similar, but some of the names have not happened, some of the actions have not happened. So even though it looks similar in a prophetic sense, it hasn't happened yet. It's yet to be fulfilled. And the interesting thing is, and I believe, let me look at my notes, I believe the number is 135, I'm sorry. There's 135 prophecies in verses 1 through 35 that have already literally been fulfilled, which is kind of a testimony again to the fact that God's prophecies have been literal in his fulfillment. And so we look at the prophecies to come and we think they'll be literally fulfilled. Now, we have to understand that people saw these visions with eyes of people from, you know, in John's case, 95 AD. So he was looking at things that may be modern, but he didn't see them that way because he didn't know what they were. So he's described them as ways that only he could describe what they are. So we have to allow for some metaphorical differences, but in terms of the major prophecies, we believe those will be literally fulfilled. We'll begin to look at those in verse 36. So take a look at 36. If you haven't read this yet, read verse 36. Read it through the end of chapter 12, because all of this from now on is a prophecy of the end times, the prophecies that have not been fulfilled, and we'll take a look at those. And they sort of set the stage for where we are today and what we'll see in our future, you know, as we go forward. Maybe not our individual future, but certainly in human kind. Anybody have any questions or comments? If you want to read the blow-by-blow history, it's here. Also, if you go into and look in histories of the Near East, you can find all of these battles and all the intrigues and all the individual Ptolemies and all the individual, you know, Antiochuses and what their names were and how long they lived and how they were killed and how they came to power. Pretty much intrigue the whole way, but the major prophecies here sort of lay out what's going to happen, and they all will fulfill exactly the way the angel pronounced them to Daniel. And I guess that's why they come out of what we call the Book of Truth, because they're true. So any comments or questions, any thoughts? Anybody read this before and look at it and say, man, I have no idea what that means? Do you still have any idea what it means? A little bit, maybe? Okay. It helps to be able to correlate the prophecies. It also helps to have a good commentary. So I would encourage you, if you're interested in prophecy, to get a couple of good commentaries. I can give you advice on what they are if you want some, and at least the ones I like anyway. But let's go to the Lord in prayer, and then we'll dismiss it upstairs. Lord, we just thank you for this time that we've had to study your word. And Lord, we thank you for the accuracy of the prophecies that we've seen in the book of Daniel. And Lord, we anticipate the prophecies to come. And Lord, we don't understand everything we read. And we understand, Lord, as we get closer to the time, some of these prophecies will become clearer to us. As we reach a point where we technologically or spiritually or whatever, we can see some of these coming to pass, Lord, your spirit will guide us in the ways that you want us to be. Lord, I ask for each one of us that we ask ourselves the question of what do you want us to do today, and that we take your word and we follow your word and try to do today what you've got for us today, and not worry about tomorrow, not worry about a year from now, but just do today what you've called us to do. Lord, I pray for the service to come. I pray for the pastor as he speaks the words you've laid on his heart. I pray for all that come. I pray for all that sing. I pray for all that talk and pray. I just pray, Lord, that all of this be done to your honor and glory. And as we worship you, that we set aside all of the cares of the day, and that we lift our heart into your presence, and we seek our tie of our spirit to your spirit so that we can just fully worship you in spirit and in truth. Lord, I pray this in the holy name of Jesus. Amen. Thank you all.